Blog Talk Radio.
Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police.
Whoop, whoop.
That's the sound of the beast.
Whoop, whoop.
That's the sound of the police.
Whoop, whoop.
That's the sound of the beast.
Whoop, whoop.
That's the sound of the police.
Whoop, whoop.
That's the sound of the beast.
Whoop, whoop.
That's the sound of the police.
Whoop, whoop.
That's the sound.
Sound of the Police, and this is the sound of Your World News, freedom, liberation, and resistance. That's what Your World News is all about. I'm your host, Solomon, and I'm joined with by the co-host, Andrea Zamudio, who is the managing editor of yourworldnews.org. If you have not been there yet, please take the time to visit our website, because our website is about you. It's about this show. It's about all of our shows before this and all of our shows after this. It's about the community. That's www.yourworldnews.org. Please check it out. We have a tremendous blog section with tons of videos, informational videos, alternative history videos, as well as just countless articles that are updated every single day, ranging from police brutality, which is the topic of the day today, and it's the topic of the day every day in America, especially if you're black or brown skinned. And it's the topic of the day is injustice, and so that's what we're going to be talking about today. So I'd like to, before I continue to run on and kick this show off, and let me not be rude, welcome to our house. And if you want to step into our house with, because our house is your house, and if you want to step into our house and issue your comment or question or feedback, anything having to do with the theme of the day today, which is police brutality, and we're going to be looking at police brutality and starting in the District of Columbia, the Dungeon of Columbia. We're going to be exploring a most recent episode of police brutality, and we're going to be expanding out to look at police brutality within the context of America, Americanism. And, you know, if anyone out there has any stories or comments that they would like to discuss centered around this issue, please feel free to call in. And that's why I meant welcome to our house, and that the key to our house is 347-945-5191. Once again, that number is 347-945-5191. You're free to call in, and please do, because this is this is not what corporate media is about, and we're not corporate media, obviously. So I want to introduce Andrea Zamudi, or let her introduce herself. And Andrea, you're here in the Dungeon Studio. Once again, if you can introduce yourself and you know, give us your thoughts to kick off the show, your thoughts about police brutality. And if you can also give our listeners, you know, especially those that are not from the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, kind of a backdrop, a contextual backdrop of why we plan this show, what's it about, and the whole story surrounding what happened to Dwight Harris a couple weeks ago, a paraplegic man.
Right. So welcome, everybody. My name is Andrea Zamudio. Really, last night we went to a meeting where there were a number of community activists talking about this issue. And that's really the motivation behind this show. Every day, every week, we see a situation of some form of police brutality in this country. But, you know, after going to yesterday's meeting, it was another opportunity to really bring this issue to light. And what happened to Mr. Harris, he is an older African-American male who is in a wheelchair, and he was outside of a metro station when police grabbed him. Two white police officers grabbed him and slammed him face first into the ground. The police department charged him with three counts. They dropped two. The one that they kept was, drinking in public. Regardless of whatever the issue would be that they could accuse him of, because, I think that the majority of the time we can say that there really is no reason. It's simply racial profiling and whatever they perceive. But let's just say that he was drinking or doing anything else. Is there ever a reason to grab someone who is disabled in some form, or just someone who is fully able, just and to slam them face first in the ground? There's not. So that's really the motivation behind today's show. So we hope that other people will call in and share their experiences, as well as something that I think was really important about last night that started off was thinking of solutions. Because I think, you know, everyone knows that this issue, or maybe not everyone, but I think a lot of people tuned in likely understand that this is an issue endemic to the African-American community, and it's something that happens week after week, and it's like relentless and difficult to hear time after time. But really, to make this solutions oriented, what can we do as a community to really start addressing this issue? And so I think that was the beautiful thing about last night, that was initiated, and I hope to see this group continue to organize and really come up with productive solutions as we see that, you know, certain things might not work because police departments are not really responsive to community involvement in these issues. So, you know, just thinking about more creative ways that we can really approach this issue.
Right. I think that I'm glad you said that, because police departments, you know, by and large, are not responsive to this issue because they are part of the problem. And so, you know, you always have an individual who may say, oh, well, you know, my dad was a police officer. He was a good police officer. I know so-and-so who was a good police officer. You know, not all police officers are bad. Listen, the broader issue, I wish it just boiled down to individuals, because then that would be a very easy fix. All right, folks, the issue is not about individual, all right, because if it was about individuals and it was about, you know, firing or putting behind bars police officers like Johann Messerlies, who is the murderer, who is the man who executed, who extrajudicially executed Oscar Grant. He was released from jail this past week. I believe it was on Sunday. And he was released after a little over a year behind bars for murdering, a murder that was caught on camera, murdered a black man. And I keep saying, we say black man. It's important to say black man, because police brutality in America, and especially, you know, the fact that police brutality in America is a scourge that runs rampant throughout black and brown communities, that is one of the many nefarious arms or vestiges of institutional racism and white supremacy in America. You can't talk about police brutality in black communities or Latino communities. You cannot talk about it within that context without mentioning police brutality, white supremacy, okay? Fear. You cannot talk about them without saying terrorism. But this 6'7" white man shot Oscar Grant in the back as he was laid face down, handcuffed. He was never armed, all right? And he got a little over a year jail time. And so we look at, for instance, you know, Michael Vick. I mean, everyone, you know, has come to use that example, that comparison and contrast, you know, but it should let you know that Michael Vick, yeah, you know, did 2 years for fighting dogs. And it should let you know, in America's eyes, black men are not as, you know, are viewed as less than dogs. You know, dogs should get more justice. I mean, that's the conclusion that we must come to, because routinely when black men or even when little black girls like Ayanna Stanley Jones in Detroit, Michigan last year, you know, being shot dead, a 7-year-old girl shot dead, and the police officer, the murderer, gets nothing. And so that's my point. It's not about individuals. It is about individuals, but the larger problem has to do with institutional racism. It has to do with a police force in America and the policing and the policy, the public policy, the government policy of policing in America has everything to do with institutional racism and how it is carried out. All right? And so we must understand that, because until we understand that institutional racism is the thread that binds us all together, We're not going to know how to fight this efficiently, and so it must be fought on policy. It must be fought uniformly. We have to come together. We have to continue to form these networks, which is the beautiful thing about last night, is that you had different organizations, different individuals that came together in Washington D.C. that are concerned about this, that are more than concerned about this, angry, infuriated, fed up, don't want to see it anymore. You know, because it's leading to more and more lives lost. We saw Delonte Rawlings, a teenager, a black boy, you know, shot and killed by the police, you know, a few years ago. Trey Joyner. I mean, we can just go on and on, and that's just in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. But these individuals, these organizations came together last night, to organize and to fight this on multiple fronts. We have to look at it as a war. And when you look at wars, you know, they're fought by land and air and sea, and so this is something that has to be fought on multiple fronts. It has to be fought on multiple fronts, and there have to be a coalition and a critical mass of people coming together, you know what I'm saying, and blasting this issue in the public everywhere, everywhere. We're talking about we need to look at the United Nations. So, yes, the United Nations is pathetic on some issues and weak on some issues, but we have to put them to the test, all right? We have to put them to the test because black people and Latino people in this country are being occupied in many ways like Palestinians are being occupied by the repressive and oppressive government of Israel. They're being occupied, and they're being policed, and they're having raids and sweeps and neighborhood sweeps, sweeping up any black boy that they find on the street after hours, sweeping them up, planting drugs on them, cocaine, all this stuff. They do this routinely. They plant it in the trunks of cars. And so don't give me this shit that it's about an individual. It's about and it can be tackled because taking care of some individuals. All right? You have some police departments in this country, LA, Cincinnati, NYPD, DC, that are some of the most corrupt, and they function like corrupt governments. You don't take care of you don't solve the issues with corrupt governments by taking care of a couple of people in the cabinet when it's pervasive throughout. No. This is fought on multiple, has to be fought on multiple fronts. And we have to look at it. And we have to look at it along racial lines because it disproportionately affects black and brown communities. We have to look at it as white supremacy. We have to look at it as institutional racism. And we have to use that language because that is the language that wakes up the rest of the globe. There has to be, wake up the rest of the globe. And so the United Nations, we would like to see the United Nations, and we need to be looking at modes and methods in terms of contacting the United Nations, writing letters to them, ad nauseum until there's some kind of uniform, stance that is taken, globally to examine police departments in the U.S. And I think, Andre, you brought up a great point. I mean, you brought up a terrific point that, it's not going to be the U.S. or it's not going to be the police department that's going to be responsible for this. And by and large, it's not going to be the U.S. that's going to do something like this without some kind of extreme pressure. And why? We can look at the example of the fact that, once again, the U.S. And this president, Barack Obama, is, for the second year in a row, is not sending anyone to the UN conference on racism, and this one happens to be in New York City, I believe this time around. We saw Bush kicking that off in 2001, where they pulled back their folks that were attending that conference, and because the conference was addressing Zionism, and oh my gosh, we have to worry about Israel and what they might think that the connection to Zionism to racism. Well, Zionism is racism, and police brutality in this country is racism. It is institutional racism. So that's that's where we're at. And I want to start off the show and I get your comments on this, Andrea. I want to play this. There was a clip that was and we have to also look at the broader modes. We have to explore. Community newspapers, black newspapers, within every community in America, progressive newspapers, and have this out there. We have to have a massive public relations campaign to raise the specter of consciousness, and so that folks know that what this is exactly, and that it's not just a select few folks that they can label as charlatans or just crazy radicals. That no, this is real, and there's a lot of people that are fighting this right now. But when we look at the U.S. corporate media, they never discuss this. And when they do discuss police brutality, 9.9 times out of 10, the blame is placed on the victim. And then the other little sliver, one-tenth of whatever percent, it's making an excuse for the police officer. It was an accident. It was merely an accident, and it's a tough job being a police officer. You know what? It's a tougher job being a black man in America. It's a tougher job being a brown man in America. It's a tougher job being a black or brown person in America than it is being a cop. Because as KRS-One once said, you were put here to protect us. Well, you really weren't put here to protect us. You were actually put there originally to protect the property of white plantation owners in the dirty, dirty South when slavery was the name of the day. And then when you moved up north, you were put there to break up unions. So you were never put here to protect black communities and brown communities. All right, but who the hell protects us from you? Who protects us from you? So I want to play this clip, Andrea, from Russia Today. And keep in mind, this is not a U.S. media outlet in any shape, form, or fashion, what you're about to hear. This is critical analysis that is coming from a Russian media, all right, Russia Today. And, you know, in certain markets in the U.S., they are on, you know, satellite or in D.C., they're on Comcast cable, but it's in like the 200s, like 274. So most folks don't even know about it. But it's just interesting that you have to get this kind of, you get this kind of analysis from a non-U.S. based news outlet. So I'm going to play this now. I want to get your feedback on this, Andrea.
Well, three New York City police officers who shot 50 bullets at a man on his wedding day, killing him, will not face criminal charges. The U.S. Justice Department says it did not find enough evidence to pursue a civil rights case. Meantime, a public outcry is growing over allegations of police brutality. RT's Marina Portnaya joins us live from New York now. So, Marina, why is the Justice Department refusing to pursue a criminal civil rights case against the NYPD officers?
Hi there, Priya. What simply put, prosecutors say they just have not found any evidence that can prove that these undercover officers acted willfully when they pulled their triggers several times, 50 shots in total. Now, the Department of Justice released a statement that said in part that negligence, fear, or mistake is not sufficient enough to establish federal criminal rights charges against these undercover officers. Now, just to give our viewers a bit of background, Sean Bell, 23-year-old man, was caught in a hail of gunfire and was shot dead back in 2006, the morning of his wedding. He was leaving his bachelor party with friends, and from what has been reported and what the officials have said, the undercover officers believe that one of Sean Bell's friends had a weapon on him. He was with two friends, and as it turned out, the police did not uncover or find any weapon after all was said and done. But this groom-to-be died in the incident the day of his wedding, a father he was at the time, and this sparked outrage throughout New York City, and tempers flared even greater in 2008 when these undercover officers were actually acquitted. Protests took place throughout New York City. So this decision obviously is going to affect the temperament of a lot of people that were looking for accountability in the death of Sean Bell, a young man who was gunned down by undercover police officers the day of his wedding.
And Marina, how has Sean Bell's family and their supporters reacted to this development?
Well, his parents did meet with officials from the Justice Department on Tuesday, and they expressed such deep disappointment. They said that it was as if they were reliving his death all over again the day of his death. His fiance or would-be wife released a statement and said to the press that she will not give up until she has the badges of those undercover officers that killed her fiance. Now, those three officers that were involved in the incident that pulled the trigger, they remain on desk duty. They're not active. They don't have a gun, but they are still employed with the NYPD. But there's been lots of comments all over the internet and blogs and posted under articles, and a lot of people are very mad because this created a debate over police brutality and the fact that if Sean Bell, many argue, was a white man, the situation wouldn't have played out the way it did. But that is obviously up for opinion. It's not one that we're going to weigh in on.
And, you know, police brutality complaints extend far beyond the borders of New York City. What kind of effect could this have on public distrust towards U.S. law enforcement officials?
That's right. Police brutality complaints and this debate and criticism does extend nationwide throughout the U.S. If you just do a search on YouTube, you'll come up with nearly 25,000 video clips of police brutality. There is a significant amount of distrust among the public that has grown over the past, I'd say, 8 years or so, but it's not something that we could provide statistics with because it's not something that's monitored at a federal level. I could tell you here in New York City, there's a report that came out recently that showed among the stop and frisk situations that take place, 87% of the people who are stopped and frisked are black or Hispanic or minorities. So obviously this doesn't help anything with the public trust between, you know, civilians and police officers, and it's something that needs to obviously continue to be worked on.
Well, that was Marina Portnaya reporting from New York, and Marina will be continuing to update us on this case throughout the day.
And again, if you want to call in, the number is 347-945-5191, 347-945-5191. I see, you know, we have quite a few people listening right now, but, you know, you can continue to listen, but if you want to, you know, chime in, call in with your comments, it's more than welcome, especially if you have an incident of police brutality that you've experienced personally or indirectly, and especially if you have any, constructive, methods or strategies that you would like to, you know, discuss to the larger public. Because, as you know, once this show's over, it will be archived indefinitely, and hopefully you'll take the link to this program and send it to all of your friends and comrades. But Andrea, if you wanted to comment on that.
You know, every time I hear these stories about how the Justice Department they don't find grounds to have an actual case, or they're not really finding any evidence. It's just ridiculous because a lot of these cases, I mean, what more evidence do you need? 50 shots? I mean, why would you ever shoot somebody that many times? Like, even if it was more than, I don't know, like, 5 or anything, but just why would you shoot somebody that many times, period? So, like, what is that? To me, that brings me back to, like, what is the image and perception of black and brown men in this country that you would have to, that so many police officers feel like they would need to shoot somebody multiple times when they think that somebody has something? So there's no, like, probable, there's no actual reason. There's nothing confirmed that they have, that they're like, oh, this is why. No, and even if it was, and like the reporter was saying, some people think if Sean Bell was a white man, it would have been different. Yes, it would have been different. How many times do you hear about a white person being shot multiple times by numerous police officers? You don't. And if you ever did, it would be a national tragedy. Like, why is that okay that's allowed in this country? Because there's an image of black and brown men that they're dangerous and they should be treated as such. And so police officers institutionally have this perception in their mind, and it's something across the board, whether they're white police officers or they're Latino or they're black police officers, because we see that happening. And people will use that to say, oh, well, see, it's not really about racism because other officers of color are doing it. Well, no, it's because it's institutional racism. So, yes, while black and Latino police officers can carry out the same practices, that's because they're trained under a system of institutional racism and white supremacy. And so, to me, it just brings me back to, it's so important that not only, the issues, the actual cases be addressed and be fought, but that something has to change in the training and the mentality of the entire police department and the justice system in this country, and with that is the media, because if there's this continuing perception of black and brown people as being dangerous and criminals and whatever, and no actual context or actual history of these people, then police officers are going to continue to believe that they are there to protect other people from these criminals, and they are going to act out in this way.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I couldn't agree more. And when we look at this issue right now, for folks that that don't know, there's a link. If you go to YouTube, or if you just go to our page, there's a link, a YouTube link. But if you want, you can just go right now while you're listening. Go to YouTube and type in DC Metro Police wheelchair, and you know what will come up will be one of the more heinous crimes that you can ever see. You know, where, as Andrea led off and said, you know, two white Metro police officers, DC Metro police officers, Washington DC, on U Street, picked up a man who was bound to his wheelchair, you know, cannot walk, thus obviously being in the wheelchair, and picked him up, and he was completely unarmed, and this was all caught on video. This was all caught on video. Picked him up and drove him, the two of them together, these two big, white, burly police officers, you know, wearing their black and with their Kevlar and all that stuff on, picked him up and drove him as if this was some kind of WWE wrestling match, all right, and drove him into the concrete. All right, so visualize this in your head if you haven't seen this. Drove him face first into the concrete, and yes, it split his face open. There was a pool of blood, and you can see this all. This is all for folks to see with their, you know, with their own eyes. A pool of blood where he had been driven into the ground, face split open, and a crowd of people in complete shock, utter shock, and helplessness of what can they do? You know what I'm saying? This is the police. They got these guns. They have a license to kill. And they quite often use that license, you know, at their own, you know, at their own amoral will. You know, these are a group of amoral individuals, many of which, you know, carry these badges and so forth. Why? Because, you know, amorality is taught within these police academies. You know, this is institutional. You know, when they have these meetings, you know, I know this very well. I know some moles who have been police officers and so forth, and have been, you know, pretty explicit in what they've told me, what occurs sometimes in the back of these within these meetings, these preparatory meetings before they're about to go out onto the so-called beat, and without a doubt, they profile black and brown men. I mean, and you know, in no hesitancy whatsoever, and no lack of words or verbiage, you know, they go out there on these quests, and they, as Andrea said, they've been built up. I mean, the media has been building this up their entire lives. You turn on the news, and you see black and brown skinned folks are overrepresented as criminals, as the perpetrators of crimes, and they're underrepresented as the victims of crimes. And this is not conjecture. This is not up for debate. This has been studies that have been done, you know, about this, on this, you know, at places like Berkeley University and their Media Policy Institute. It's all out there for folks to do their research. I mean, it's, you know, but this plays a large role into the public public policy of policing in America, because they take those built up stereotypes and fears that have been driven into them, you know, by the corporate media, the one sided corporate media, and you know, when they go through you know, their police academies, you know, all these things and what they've seen in the media are reinforced. They're reinforced and further driven into them and become embedded, and, you know, leave these indelible imprints on their psyches, you know, for them to go out there and carry it out, and whether it means shooting Timothy Stansberry, you know, or, you know, killing Patrick Dorsman, shooting Oscar Grant, Adolph Grimes, you know, this is what happens. This is what happens over and over again. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm sure that this is not going to be the last instance of police brutality that we end up talking about, because, you know, while we're in the process of trying to organize and fight this, you know, the culture of the day is going to continue on, and that's why we have to fight even more aggressively and be steadfast and unified, and we have to put our egos in check in the back burner, leave our egos, you know, at the door, and understand that this is we have to do things for the betterment of this movement. This is a human rights movement. This is not a civil rights. This is a human rights movement. I think that's exactly what, you know, one of my heroes, the Prophet Malcolm X, would have said. You know, and speaking of Malcolm X, I think that this is what Malcolm X has often said about American courts. You know, you know, those of you who are interested in becoming involved in any shape, form, or fashion, I should say this, anyone that's interested in becoming involved, even if you're there someplace else in the country, and we know that, you know, the black community in Miami, you know, is going through a number of things right now, because we saw the you know, which is also on YouTube now, the murder of a black man who was sitting in his car, and they open up fire, and they just shot into that car I don't know how many times, and you know, filled the car and him with bullets, a 22-year-old black man. This is something that happened very recently over the Memorial Day weekend in Miami, Florida. And, you know, so, but it, as I was saying, you know, if you want to become involved and help out and to link up, and I think that even if you're in a city that's dealing with similar things right now, I think that there's a lot to be said for solidarity, and I think it's important for you to reach out to us. But one of the primary organizers in the D.C. area around this is a brother by the name of Najee Muhammad, and you know, his email, you know, he's given me permission to give his email out. His email is runawayblood@gmail.com. That's RUNAWAYBLOOD@gmail.com. That's runawayblood@gmail.com. Really, really good brother, and he is one of the primary organizers and facilitators of this. So, you know, definitely, you know, reach out and send him an email. And if any of you want to message me for more information, I can, you know, send you his email and Jonathan's email as well, if you want to get involved. But let's take it to my prophet, you know, Malcolm X, you know, and see what he had to say about American courts many, many moons ago, you know, where police brutality and the murder of Black Panthers and those black men and women who, you know, who, you know, had the audacity to speak out and to organize and to fight against and to resist against what we see a continuation all the way into 2011. Here's Malcolm X on American courts.
For 8 weeks in Los Angeles, 14 so-called Negroes set on trial, charged by the police with assault, charged by the police with intent to commit murder. You haven't read anything about it in the paper. You haven't seen anything about it and heard anything about it from these blue-eyed white so-called liberals. They quieted it down. They hushed it up. And none of the Negro leaders opened up their mouths during the trial. They were silent while they had a rally of 35,000 Negroes in one of those states, Wrigley Field, in Los Angeles, while the all-white jury was in session. And not one of them came forth and mentioned what had happened to those 14 Negroes in that city. And they wonder why things are developing to what they are today. No, you don't get justice in court. A black man can't get justice in court. A black man can't get justice in the court system of America. And I'm telling you, the only way you get justice is in the street. The only way you get justice is in the sidewalk. The only way you get justice is when you make justice for yourself. You never will get justice in the white man's court. No, not me. I never want him to take me to court. I saw what he did with my brothers. I see what he has done with them right here in New York City. So make sure you obey the law. Make sure you never commit a crime. Make sure you never deviate from the law. But any time one of them puts his hands on you, take him off the planet. Take him off the planet. justice in America. No, I'll tell you that if the man locked me up in the morning, don't expect any justice. And when our brothers, Rikers Island, city prison, filled with Negroes who become Muslims, want to stop drinking, want to stop smoking, want to pull the needle out of their arm, you think that blind thing out there will help them? No. He puts them in solitary confinement because they want to be Muslim. I'm telling you what Mayor Wagner does and what Governor Rockefeller does, that they're a race of devils. And I pray that God will strike them. Yes, I pray that God will strike them. Put death in their family, death on their relatives, and death on their friends. I pray that God will bring that on. Yes, I pray that God will strike them with death and disease and destruction and misery and grief, because they have put it on us. And when God gives it to them, no one can say that God is unjust.
Andrea, some people would say those are some harsh comments, especially folks that are not looking at the context of society in which Malcolm X is speaking. And they'll say, oh, that's some harsh rhetoric. You know, and it's to me, it's kind of amusing when people, you know, say that about some of the strong words that Malcolm X had without looking at some of the stronger, you know, look beyond the rhetoric. Okay, if you want to call it strong rhetoric, so be it. All right, without making any comment, Andrea, about the even stronger actions of vastly repressive and murderous and terrorist FBI led by J. Edgar Hoover and a terrorist police force, you know, which, you know, where we're speaking in New York City, and the context in terms of what he was talking about, especially looking at, you know, the murder of the you know, Black Panthers and by the police officers in Los Angeles County. So you know, what would be your response to that in terms of, you know, those that might speak on that so-called harsh rhetoric that we just heard Malcolm X issuing out?
Yeah, I was saying the same thing. I mean, people don't think about the realities of what is happening in the Black community. So while Malcolm might be saying that, what were the realities of that time in the Black community and today, right? A lot of this, what we're talking about, the police brutality. And something that he said about, you know, like the juries being all white and that you're not going to get justice because it's never going to be equal, it's not going to be representative at all. It made me think about when they were considering Sonia Sotomayor. And I may not agree with her politics, but I thought it was interesting that throughout that period, the media was constantly referring to, and a lot of people who were evaluating her were referring to the fact that she was a female and that she was Latina and that she was raised in an impoverished community and then how that would affect her judgment. So, and the reason that what Malcolm said made me think of that is that I think it's interesting how that's always discussed and how maybe Black people on a jury or Latino people on a jury or judges may affect the verdict, but it's never discussed that white males might have a bias, or that an all-white jury might have a bias on prosecuting white police officers. And so to me, that's very telling. So all of a sudden, race and gender become very prevalent in this decision. When it's a person of color or a woman, but somehow when it's white males making decisions, that, you know, they're completely objective. They completely follow the law, and whatever they decide is what's going to be right.
Right, right. And you know, just looking even deeper than that, we can see with the Oscar Grant, you know, trial, or you know, to try to seek justice against his murderer, Johan Mezerlis. We saw that in 2010, you know, in 2009, the jury that was assigned to this racist pig that murdered Oscar Grant was an all-white jury. Was a completely all-white jury, and
right.
Then and they even moved it out of
exactly.
of Oakland, California. They moved it all the way to Southern California.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
So, you know, I don't know if you want to, you know, even expound upon that a little bit more.
I mean, I just think that that's usually how it is. It's very telling, and you know, you don't really see juries that are representative of the community where an incident occurred. That example is perfect, and that happens consistently. Or the, you know, systematic exclusion of black people in a jury because they might have a bias. They might be supportive of a black victim of police brutality, which is just completely absurd.
Right, and I don't know, you know, when we're going to see, you know, let me tell you this. All right, we're going to see it when we continue to organize, and where you have police brutality issues that are going on, there are people behind the scenes that obviously the corporate media is not going to discuss. They're not going to have profiles about this activist and that activist that are working, you know, diligently behind the scenes. They're not going to have them out there. But best believe, in each of these cities where it's going on, you have activists that are behind the scenes that are working very diligently to fight this. All right. The only thing that might be there is that, you know, they may not have, you know, as large an army of activists that they need, you know, to really advance that struggle. And that's why it's so important that we utilize you know, our publications, our independent publications, and our independent media, whether it's an online, you know, radio show like this one, or even cause radio, where, you know, wherever we can further the dialogue about police brutality and to have constructive conversations that are based around exposing these issues, exposing these crimes, and then taking it to the next level. Like, what can people do, you know, in terms of, you know, working together and, you know, working strong behind the scenes to get this stuff in front of the bloody veil basically, I would say just so-called mainstream America as possible, because without that happening, you know, and an interesting thing is that, you know, I was talking to you about this off air, Andrea, is that we look at 2010 and we have a 7-year-old black girl from Detroit, Michigan, Ayanna Stanley Jones, who is no longer on planet Earth. She was murdered by the police. And what's interesting, they were filming some kind of reality show being filmed at the same time, and so you have these rogue police officers that are all like beefed up and based up on adrenaline, all right, knowing that you know these cameras are on them from afar, and you know, and so they go in there, they say, oh, you know, that you know, we're going there to bust into a you know, her family's home, all right, because there's supposed to be some alleged murderer that, you know, or criminal in there. So they bust into the house, and shots are fired. One of those shots, and I let you know, there were no shots that left the house. There were no shots that were initially fired outside the house. There were no shots fired, you know, after the police went in there, shot in, you know, canisters, shock canisters, shot in there, and then went in there and began to shoot their guns. I mean, this is the lack. They know the family. I mean, so for instance, they don't even know what the hell is in there. They have no idea, but they don't give a damn. They don't give a damn if there's a 7-year-old girl laying on the couch. They don't care. Black life means nothing to them. For all they know, they could be shooting quail or deer. They don't care. They don't care. So they go in there and shots are fired and a bullet goes through the throat and of Ayanna Stanley Jones and leaves right below, you know, the base of her head, and she's no longer. And so when we compare and contrast, we look at what happened last year. Or I guess it was early this year when we looked at what happened in Arizona, where that crazed lunatic, Jared Loughner, Tucson, Arizona, shot Gabby Giffords and shot other folks, and one of the victims who lost their life was a white girl, a little white girl who was born on 9/11. And no child needs to be brutally murdered. No child needs to be brutally murdered, and especially, in that kind of manner, in any kind of manner. I mean, that's just, you know, reprehensible on every single level. But here's the interesting thing, America, or who's ever listening right now, wherever you are, here's the interesting thing about America. I want you to listen loud and clear. Think about this. So, President Barack Obama, so that the young girl dies, and very, very unfortunate, and without a doubt, tragic. When a young child dies, it's extremely tragic, especially in that manner. So Barack Obama goes out there, has a press conference. I mean, something like, you know, he addresses and issues condolences to the victims and speaks on it and is very eloquent you know, as he usually is very eloquent and says some very deep words about the young girl who died and even, you know, said that, you know, she's, you know, probably watching this from heaven and, you know, dancing and, you know, and hopping in little puddles like she used to, and it was very, very touching, very touching. And at that moment, Andrea, if you remember that, at that moment, America, because this little girl's face and image and her death, her brutal death, were placed out there, people across the country felt sorry. I mean, it was, you know, came together and just said, yo, this is ridiculous. I mean, more conversations started to come up about, you know, gun laws and so forth. And everyone was, it was, you know, someone, we joined akimbo, figuratively, around the death of this little girl. Now I want to ask you this, folks that are listening. When Ayanna Stanley Jones died brutally by some other crazed murderers, one in particular who shot that gun, who is nothing, you know, who is a crazed murderer, you know, in his own way, rogue cop, is, you know, where was the national outrage there? So yes, there were activists and people in the black community and activists from all different, you know, hues and backgrounds, you know, in very small numbers that even knew about this. But most people didn't even know about this. Didn't even know about her death. Because why? This wasn't across the MSNBC headlines and, you know, having deep dialogues about this. This wasn't front page, having her face on Time magazine or in the New York Post. This wasn't blasted all over the Detroit Free Press. This is something that has been kept kept in the smallest margins, marginalized by the bloody corporate media and Americanism in general. Why? Because we have to ask the deeper question. We have to address this, folks. The deeper issue, because, let's face it, because she's a little black girl. Emphasis on the word black. And her life, I guess, to the corporate media that didn't think it was necessary to have this issue and to bring this dialogue into every home, into the tens of millions of homes that these corporate media outlets like MSNBC and ABC, and we know the white nationalists, white supremacists, Fox News wasn't going to do a damn thing about it, so, you know, save that. But these other outlets, nothing. Why? Because we have to come to the conclusion they don't give a damn about little black girls. They don't give a damn about little black girls being shot. I'm going to say it like that. I am going to say it like that, because if that doesn't deserve headline news throughout every single media outlet and lead to a deeper discussion about policing in America when the victim becomes a 7-year-old black girl, not a grown man, not that it's warranted in any shape, form, or fashion, but when it wreaks havoc on a 7-year-old black girl, if that does not warrant national news coverage, I will tell you, I don't know what is, and I will tell you even deeper. That is an indictment on America herself. That is indictment on Americanism. That is an indictment on policing in America itself. We have to look at it at that manner, very bluntly, very straightforwardly. That is what it is. And so, yes, it is repressive, because if it wreaks havoc on a 7-year-old black girl in Detroit, Michigan, then are we surprised when two burly white cops pick up a paraplegic black man while on camera and drive him face first into the concrete, busting his head open? And you know what? He could have been killed. When you do that, the body, yes, in some instances can be very strong, but the body also, the certain blows, as we've seen with boxers, take certain, just one blow or a couple blow in certain boxing matches, go into comas and never wake up. So we have to look at this, honestly, folks, the same way they look at it with other things. That's attempted murder. That is attempted murder. That is attempted murder. Because if I went out there and picked up myself, not being a police officer, and I picked up, you know, a white man in a wheelchair and drove him face first into the concrete as they did, I guarantee you the charges brought forth against me would be nothing short of attempted murder. And that is exactly what it is. These police officers need to lose their jobs, and they need to be brought forth on criminal charges. And the police department itself should have a civil suit brought against it. These folks have to be hit in the pocketbook, and they have to be hit at every single angle. Bad publicity. Because, it has to be bad publicity. There's no good publicity, you know, in situations like this, you know, and also with a police force that has this kind of legacy. Right?
Exactly. I just want to go to some of the solutions or objectives that were discussed last night. I'm just going to put them out there, and you know, if you want to discuss them more specifically. But, you know, just coming together, as you mentioned, Solomon, in the beginning, this is a community effort, so people representing a lot of different organizations. So coming under this network of a anti-police brutality initiative, some of the more long-term things were to create a Know Your Rights campaign. So creating spaces, whether it's in libraries, schools, and churches, having different people within the community that are involved in this being trained to train the rest of the community about how to deal with situations with the police. And the thing with that is that it's difficult because really, in a lot of these cases, individuals aren't really doing anything to warrant this harassment. So, it's one of those things where it's like, it's something that is definitely important for us to know our rights, but that's not really at the core of the issue. Nonetheless, it is definitely important to know how to deal with them. And, you know, just having town halls, definitely getting the word out like this through smaller independent media collectives, as well as trying to get it into more mainstream news outlets, and creating a list of demands. So some of the demands that were discussed were dropping the charges on Mr. Harris and demanding that the police officers be charged with assault or with attempted murder. And, you know, having a phone and email drive to put pressure on the prosecutors to start dealing with this issue now, and seeing that, you know, if we have a phone and email drive, letting them know that there are people aware of what's going on and that are behind this cause and really want to put pressure on them so they know that we are here. So, those are some of the things that were discussed. I hope that some of the people listening will call and, give us other solutions that maybe they have seen that have worked, or just suggestions or ideas that they might have.
Right. I'm glad you put that out there, and there's stuff that folks can do even immediately, wherever you're at, is educating yourself on the Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, especially the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, and we should know that it's a very imperfect document. It's a document that wasn't written with black people's interests in mind in any shape, form, or fashion. So when they're talking about, all these different rights and this, that, and the other, they're not talking about, and for that matter, the Declaration of Independence and mentions of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and we have to understand that slavery was still alive and well, so they weren't meant, inferring, the rights of black people in any shape, form, or fashion, and then we look at the 14th Amendment, which is supposed to be put there to protect the rights of newly freed African slaves, right? But the primary beneficiaries from the 14th Amendment, were corporations. White corporations found a way to utilize the 14th Amendment to under the guise of being a so-called legal citizen, in essence a human being. They utilized that far more times far more times than newly freed African people, from the bondage of slavery. But it is important, though, as long as you're living in the U.S., as long as you are in Babylon, you should have a working understanding of some of these laws, because not knowing what to say when you're accosted by the police while walking or driving, it's important to, and I want to put out an important website where you can get stuff from Know Your Rights, about knowing your rights, and also just even in general, just basic things in terms of just being able to print out things, small documents, and to fold them and put them in your purse or your wallet or your pocket, or tape them on the dashboard of your car. You can go to the ACLU, and their website is just ACLU.org, American Civil Liberties Union, and they have a Know Your Rights pamphlet that can be printed out there in a PDF document. I did that. I made dozens and dozens and gave them out to friends and folks that I knew, and anyone I could come in contact with. I think it's important that we disseminate this information far and wide. But also, another website is www.itj-pdn.yolasite, and that's the Institute for Tsunamic Justice. And they've got a lot of great information there, a ton of great information there, especially surrounding police brutality in D.C. and in this country as well. And once again, it's www.itj-pdn.yolasite.com. I want to play this clip since we were talking about Ayanna Stanley Jones. This is Dr. Jared Ball from Black Agenda Report, and this was, put out last year, this was his comments and his thoughts regarding the police murder of Ayanna Stanley Jones, and you know, even exploring a deeper context. So I want to, you know, take a brief break from our voices and turn it over to the voice of Dr. Jared Ball. And once again, hopefully, if you decide to, you call. I see there's a lot of folks listening right now, especially in the chat room. You know, you don't have to call in if you don't want to, no pressure. But if you do, like I said, this show is for you as well as every show is for you. 347-945-5191.
Her name was Ayanna Jones. She was 7, black, in a poor family, living in Detroit, and was killed by the police. She was the victim of an unbroken and thoroughly vicious cycle of police brutality, followed by temporary, short-lived outcry, and then the soon-to-come oppressive silence, or worse, acceptance. Most will never hear the story, fewer will hear and follow up on it, and fewer still will have yet another name to list during self-aggrandizing moments on podia, panels, or in various forms of media commentary. The national eulogizer, Al Sharpton, spoke at Ayanna's funeral this week and said again that this child is the breaking point, enough is enough, which I am sure a search would show he has said in one form or another at the never-ending cavalcade of funerals he does. But is it really enough? Is Ayanna really a breaking point? Absolutely not, and we know it. Precise numbers are hard to pin down, but one study concluded that from 1990 to 2005, an average of one person per day was killed by the police. And in Chicago, for example, of the 84 people killed by police since 2000, only one was determined to be unjustified. But between underreporting and unjust legal conclusions of incidents that are reported, there remains this unbroken cycle. This cycle is irritatingly too easy to foresee and has, of course, already begun in the case of Ayanna Jones. This includes the obligatory and already mentioned Sharpton eulogy, followed by some basic local and national news coverage. Some have raised important questions about, for instance, the television show The First 48, which was there filming the police raid which led to Ayanna's death, and the role of what has to be euphemistically called reality TV in general in encouraging more action or prompting a greater degree of excessive behavior among the police. Some have asked about muted media, whose lack of substantive coverage prevents an appropriate societal education about police brutality or race in America. Of course, others prefer to focus on allegations that the Jones family was not well-liked in their community and were themselves seen as a bad element, especially since the police were there looking for a murder suspect who was found either in or right next to the Jones household. But other news reported recently speaks to the true nature of this cycle. For example, Black Agenda Report carried a story last week, which was a follow-up to the Jenna 6 case, the last major pre-Haiti earthquake cause célèbre, which showed that rather than progress, there has only been further repression and targeting of families and individuals who supported the 6 black victims of that case. The federal probe into police killings of black people in post-Katrina New Orleans is still ongoing more than 5 years later. And John Burge, the former Chicago police chief who ran a torture ring that abused approximately 200 suspects during the 1970s and 80s, finally goes on trial this week, decades later. During a recent discussion with the powerful sibling duo of Michelle and Leslie Alexander, whose scholarship and activism centers around the history of criminalizing blackness, the two made the point that these issues are the result of a legacy of enslavement which has seemingly permanently inscribed an archetype of black people as property and predators, demanding levels of social control which are only viewed as extreme or unjust if applied outside that context or outside those communities. They also both noted the human rights nightmare of police brutality and mass incarceration are just not seen by black leadership as issues worthy of popular attention precisely because they often involve segments of our communities we'd rather escape from or simply not acknowledge. It is the concern summarized by Obama's willingness to defend his similarly classed Skip Gates while dismissing as issues the killings of the underclassed Sean Bell or Oscar Grant. And it is also why this cycle is so vicious and why it is predictable that this little girl's name will soon be added to the list of the forgotten. Her name was Ayanna Jones. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Jared Ball. Online, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So I just want to go over a couple of the rights that you have if you are pulled over or you're stopped by the police if you're walking. This is from the Institute of Economic Justice. So the first one is to remain silent and refuse to answer questions because anything you say will be used against you in court. And something that I remember when I was working with an organization in Maryland, working with immigrant rights, also is that if they continue to ask you anything besides your name, you don't have to respond. So that if they ask you, you know, what country you're from or how you got here or anything, I mean, not even that, but just in general, like, I believe you have to say your name, but beyond that, you don't have to say anything. So if they ask you, you know, for whatever reason, if you don't have your license or you don't have something, you can just say, I have the right to remain silent, or I have the right to not comment. The next one is consult with an attorney before speaking to the police and have an attorney present during any questioning. Oftentimes, police officers, you know, will try to intimidate you and say that you have to answer, or you know, that you can't afford an attorney, or whatever. You know, don't allow that to be something that pressures you from knowing that you actually do have the right to an attorney, and that you don't have to respond to anything unless you have an attorney present. And yes, the third one goes along with that. So if you can't afford an attorney, then you can demand that one be appointed to you before any questioning occurs. And number four is keep your private items out of view. That's really important just because now, I don't know if a lot of people have heard, but they can take your cell phone and go through your cell phone or your wallet or anything really. And but with the cell phones, they have this new like device where they can basically download everything that's in your cell phone and try to incriminate you with whatever information's in there. So it's important, you know, just and just not reaching for anything in general, because that, you know, that's been an issue in for example, in the case of Amadou Diallo, where they said he was reaching for his wallet, and we've heard that number of times, of his phone or whatever, and they thought they were the individual was reaching for a gun or a weapon. And number five is be courteous and non-confrontational. As hard as that can be, because we know that police officers are definitely the opposite of that and beyond, you know, with harassment and brutality. But, you know, just try to stay calm as much as you can and not be confrontational. And that goes along with not resist, do not physically resist. So if a police officer does detain you or is searching you or arresting you, you know, doing what they ask you to do and not physically resisting, because that can just lead to escalating the situation. And also, you do have the right to say no to warrantless searches. So just making sure that they have a warrant and that it's signed by a judge. Sometimes we've heard of cases where they have a fake warrant and it's signed by an officer or just some, you know, regular individual. So making sure that it is signed by a judge. And also asking them if you can leave. So a lot of times police officers won't officially say you're arrested or you're being detained and they'll refuse to answer you, but you can continue to ask and ask. And if they say, well, you're not being arrested, you're not being detained, then you can ask them, do I have permission, like, I can leave, like, you have the right to leave, but just making sure that, you know, they have said that you are not being arrested or detained.
Yeah. It's I mean, that's really, really important information, and you know, I appreciate you reading that. That's, you know, vastly important information, and it's got to be stuff. It has to be information, honestly, that becomes, you know, pretty much intrinsic within all of our you know, our data banks. It really has to be. Something that's intrinsic and because it's an additional weapon or a piece of armor, you know, to somewhat protect us, you know, as we continue to fight to hopefully revamp, to deconstruct, to reconstruct, to deconstruct police in America as we know it, to reconstruct it into something that is much more humane, that actually is about, you know, protecting and serving communities. But right now, it's not. There is no equilibrium. There is no social equilibrium. It's completely out of whack. This society in America has has social vertigo. It's completely off, and it's slanted all the way to one side. With white and opulent communities, but those of us who are of color, those of us who are on lower economic rungs, we can expect to be policed with extreme vengeance and aggression. And it's something that's been going on for a long time. So I understand the amount of pessimism that may go on with folks saying that, hey, this is America, man. This is not going to change. I totally understand that pessimism. I really do. But just like if we were drowning, if someone was drowning, you would fight like hell to try to stay afloat. So you may end up drowning and lose your life, but you're not going to go down without a fight. You're not going to go down with a fight. You're going to resist. You're going to resist that water as much as you can. And you're going to continue to try to thrust your body up, above the wave or above the water itself to just grasp and a bit of air with your mouth, with your nose, hoping that there may be something—a log or a boat or a passerby—that you can grab. To pull you to safety, and that's the way we got to look at it. Yeah, in a lot of ways, we're drowning, and that's what's called repression. We're being pushed down, and we're being suppressed and oppressed and being pushed down. But we have to continue to fight. We have to be vigilant, and we have to use our collective intellectual capital. From one community to the next, from one family to the next, and we have to continue to grasp. We have to keep fighting. Resistance has been something that has always been around. Since European invaders came to this country and usurped the land from indigenous people, they fought like hell. They fought like hell. They fought like hell. And then when they brought Africans over here, over to the Western Hemisphere, from, what's known as there's the U.S. all the way down to South America, we know that even though it may not be taught in the school systems, they fought like hell. From the Stono Rebellion to Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, Harriet Tubman, people fought like hell. The Cimmeroons, the Maroons. They fought like hell. They resisted. We got to resist, and we have to resist in a 2011 version, in a 2011 manner. We have to resist. We have to organize. We have to mobilize. We have to use all of our talents and our capacities that we've been trained in. So those of you that are law, that are lawyers, offer up, your skill sets. Offer up your skill sets to possibly do, a Bill of Rights training. Those of you that have some kind of criminal justice background, find ways to have workshops in the basements of churches that are willing to bring you in. To community centers where there's a dialogue and a discussion and workshops around knowing your rights, right? We have to do these things, and at the same time we also have to look at ways to bring it to a higher level, the attention, drafting strong press releases that are sent to everybody. Everybody and anybody, knowing that some of these bums are not going to even read the letters, but we have to cast it as broad a brush as we possibly can, even if it means going door to door in our communities and having discussions and inviting people to forums, because we have to move beyond just protesting. And yes, we have to move beyond forums. We have to move beyond targeted actions, but this is a part of it. This is a part of it. You know, these meetings and these things lead to targeted actions. I mean, that's where sometimes some of the best ideas are birthed, but people have to check their egos at the door. But I think everything, you know, we have to look at a lot of different modes, and we have to fight it legally. We have to look at pressing charges, and that's where the people with the legal background, can work with us, pressing charges and looking at, battling and making sure that we're bringing this fight to not just local DAs, but bringing this fight to U.S. attorneys, to the Attorney General himself, Eric Holder, if need be. Matter of fact, it does need be. So bringing it to him, to Eric Holder himself, these things have to be done. You know, and we have to think outside the box, and that's where the United Nations, drafting. You know, resolutions. I remember, you know, a few years ago when we marched in protest from the D.C. Police headquarters to the Justice Department. That was one thing that we did. But one of the other things that was done. The brothers from Ceasefire, they started a letter that an appeal letter that was sent to the and got signatories from a wide range of people, and this was a well put together document that was then sent on to the UN headquarters in New York City. You know, to me, I think that's a stroke of genius. I mean, it has to be important. And also another thing that was discussed, Andrea, if you remember last night, was the whole notion, I mean, the whole idea that we have to document. Every time something happens in your community, whether it's yourself or whatever, we have to get the information out. We have to document these things. The complaints have to, so even as pessimistic as it may be, is to say, you know what, these police, these MFers ain't going to do a damn thing. You still got to document it. Document it and file the official complaints, because what they have to do, they have to put these things on file, and it creates paper trails. And that has to be looked at as something that may sound like it's defeatist, but or just not going to work, but it's important, especially for the next person that comes along that gets profiled in the same manner you did. That documentation, creates a very long paper trail, and so we have to explore those things as well. I don't know if there's anything I'm missing, Andrea.
The only thing I would add is something that was brought up last night as well, is that if you're videotaping a situation where you see a situation of police brutality, ensuring that you get the police officer's face. And whether you're being
badge numbers too.
Yeah, that's what I was saying too. Like, whether it's it's happening to you or you're witnessing it, ensuring that you get the badge number of the officer. Obviously not directly asking them, because they're going to be very confrontational and trying to cover it up or even taking their badge off, but just discreetly when, they're talking to you, just looking at it and, just repeating, try and memorize it, because all those things, are evidence that can be used to defend yourself or if you're a witness to a situation of police brutality. But I think that something that was really important is definitely getting a good view of their face if you are able to tape it. But either way, both of those are incredibly important, because that way you have something solid to trace back to who specifically it was.
Right. So that's going to do it for this show. Thank you everyone for tuning in, and as we always say, if you can please make sure that you pass the link to this show along to all your networks. Send it out to everyone on your email list and tell them, please just click on this and listen to this. You can download it to your iTunes, and listen it to the, from there, and then, or you can, you know, download it from there onto your iPod or your MP3 player, or just listen to it from your computer. But you know, but tell them to listen. So Andre, I'm gonna give you the request. I'll let you choose the which song we're gonna go out with. So I've got a couple songs that I think are good. We got Prince Paul and Everlast, you know, from Prince Among Thieves, you know, Men in Blue. We have N.W.A. with Fuck the Police. We got Brother Ali with American Nightmare. Or we got KRS-One, you know, we've already heard him with Black Cop.
Wow. I think I'm gonna go with N.W.A.
All right, you said it, man. If you guys don't like Fuck the Police, it was Andre and not me. Hey, but you know what? This is a good song. Fuck the Police.
Police coming straight from the underground. Young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. I'm not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on and thrown in jail. We can go toe to toe in the middle of a sale. Fucking with me cause I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager. Searching my car, looking for the product, thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. You rather see me in the pen than me and Lorenzo rolling in a Benzo. Be the police out of shape, and when I finish, bring the yellow tape to tape off the scene of the slaughter. Still getting swole up bread and water. I don't know if they fagged or what. Search a nigga down and grabbing his nuts. And on the other hand, without a gun, it can't get none. But don't let it be a black and a white one, cause they'll slam you down to the street top. Black police showing out for the white cop.
Behavior. Yeah, I'm a gangster, but still I got flavor. Without in the bag, what do you got? A sucker in a uniform waiting to get shot by me or another nigga. And with a gat, it don't matter if he's smaller or bigger. And as y'all know, E's here the rule. Whenever I'm rolling, keep looking in the mirror and is on cue, yo, so I can hear a dumb motherfucker with a gun. And if I'm rolling off the eight, he'll be the one that I take out and then get away. While I'm driving off laughing, this is what I'll say. Fuck the police. Fuck, fuck the police. Fuck, fuck, fuck the police. Fuck the police.
The verdict. The jury finds you guilty of being a redneck, white bread, chicken shit motherfucker.